We're going to touch on that later on with Mr. Nayari joining me after our first guest here on the show. Joining me on the line right now is a man who's all things Yorkshire, or is it Lancashire? I can never remember, but he's definitely out there in Mexico City, giving a flair of Northern England down to the Mexican culture. He's Mr. Tom Marshall, talking all things Mexican club and national team football, joining us on the line today. Tom, how are you, mate?
Very good, Lancashire.
Lancashire, yeah. I knew as soon as I said Yorkshire, I was like, "Nah, he's gonna get the other coloured rose out for me and wave it in my face or something." How are you, man? It's been too long since we had you on the show. You been keeping well?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, busy. A lot of obviously with the national team, the roller coaster ride of qualifying, it's kept me pretty occupied.
It's going through hell if you're a Mexican national team football fan, a Mexican football fan in general, when you look at this national side. We've spoken about it a fair bit on the show, but your thoughts quickly on Chep De La Torre. Was his departure too late? Should it have happened a lot earlier, do you think, Tom?
Yeah, I think, I mean, looking back, it should have done. I mean, hindsight tells you that definitely it should, but, you know, I think the Federation, just because I think there's been one coach since 1970 for Mexico that's gone like 4 years, like a 4 year World Cup cycle. So I think the Federation were trying to, like, you know, really trying to keep a manager on for a full cycle. But obviously, you know, as soon as that World Cup place legitimately came under threat, then he had to go.
And it really is under threat. The hexagonal round has been a disaster in terms of Mexican football. So many surprise results all kind of started with that shock draw with Jamaica. Do you see them qualifying, Tom? Do you really think that there's enough in this side to be able to, maybe not just talent-wise, but heart and emotionally invested in this national team side to get them out of this situation?
Yeah, I think they're going to qualify. I think the new coach, Victor Manuel Vucetich, is very good. I think he's going to change the team quite a lot. I think he's going to bring in quite a few experienced players, like Rafa Márquez is the big name that everyone thinks he's going to call up. So I think they've got enough. But I mean, the bottom line is, if they don't improve on the performances against the US and the performance against Honduras, they're not going to go. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, if they don't get better, then they're not going to go.
We've seen, obviously, a number of changes to this side. Do you think that they know their best starting 11 yet, the Mexican national team? Or is there going to be... Are we still going to have to see maybe a little bit of feeling out time? I suppose it's nice that there's a nice break until the last encounters in the hexagonal for the deciding playoff places and automatic places.
Yeah, well, actually, it's the new coach, Vucetich, has come in and he's called, like, extra training sessions for the Mexico-based players. So they're going to be getting together for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday for a couple of weeks, you know, to really work out tactics and how they're going to play and stuff like that. And I think he's going to go for some experienced heads, like I said, Rafa Márquez, but also maybe Oswaldo Sanchez and I mean, the big one's Carlos Vela. I mean, he is the most on-form Mexico player anywhere in the world right now. He's absolutely quality if you watch Real Sociedad closely. The real heartbeat of the team there. And, you know, I think the big thing in Mexico at the minute is Vela going to come back? And he's been flirting a bit with the Federation. And I think he's going to come back, and I think it's going to be a big help to have him back.
They're going to need that playmaker, of course, at national team level, at domestic level, especially in the CONCACAF Champions League, Tom. It's going rather smoothly for the Mexican side. I don't want to, you know, touch wood kind of thing and jinx anything like that. But with America, Toluca and Tijuana all on top of their groups, it's really only Cruz Azul that are holding everybody back at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of them have played it quite well in terms of using the squads. I mean, you look at a team like America and the squad's just massive, you know what I mean? They've got international players on the bench and they've been playing those players in the CONCACAF Champions League. And I think they're very serious about doing well in this competition. Tijuana, the same. You know, they've got the experience from last season in the Copa Libertadores. They know what it's like to go and travel, stay over, you know, to deal with the... I mean, it just takes a lot out of you to go to these places and, you know, and try and get a result.
I apologise there, Tom. Something's just popped up on my computer screen. I really am sorry about that. That's a bit annoying. Sorry, mate. Could you start that answer again? I do apologise, man.
What was it again?
It was about the Mexican side doing very well in CONCACAF Champions League at the moment, and only Cruz Azul holding them all back at the moment. And you were touching on Club America and how they're treating this very seriously, really going for CONCACAF Champions League at the moment.
Okay.
When you're ready, mate.
Okay. No, yes. I mean, it's going really well for the Mexican teams at the minute. I mean, you know, you've got a club like America, obviously the champions, who just by the name. And the, you know, the name America is named after a continent. The badge is the American continent. You know, probably the best squad in Mexico at the minute. I mean, they're really having a good go at this competition to try and get to the Club World Cup. You know, just they've been using, you know, the normal subs and stuff in the league games, but even there they've got international quality players. So, you know, and the way the structure is of the CONCACAF Champions League. With the three teams in each group, I mean, there isn't really much room to slip up. So I think the Mexican clubs have really, really gone for it this time. You know, Tijuana as well, they've played in the Copa Libertadores last year, did really well. And I think they're used to that travelling, which obviously takes a lot out of players. But I think they've really, the management of the team and the, you know, it's been really good there for Tijuana. And, yeah, Toluca, they've surprised me, but I thought they might struggle a little bit. They've been a bit inconsistent in the league, but in the CONCACAF Champions League, they seem to be doing well, more than okay, doing very well. And Cruz Azul's the one, like you mentioned there, that you know, that could be the a bit tricky. I mean, they've got Valencia from Haiti next up, which you expect them to, you know, 3-4, 5-0. But then they've got the last game's Herediano in Costa Rica, so that could be the deciding game, and that could be the only chance that I see of a Mexican team not being in the knockout stage.
The two sides that really catch my eye with this are Club America and Club Tijuana. With TJ, you mentioned there being in Libertadores preparing them for this CONCACAF Champions League. Is it very much kind of like a bit more of a walk in the park for Tijuana, having been in the Libertadores last year, being given that baptism of fire, if you will, now stepping into CONCACAF competition, does it seem like a lot easier for them?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think obviously there is a difference in quality, but at the same time, if you go down, I mean, I think they played in Honduras a few weeks ago, and there was, you know, a thunderstorm, you know, stopped the game for quite a long time. And, you know, it's not easy going down to these places where a lot of the time the pitches aren't very good. So I think it's a different kind of challenge. I think playing in the Copa Libertadores last season, doing so well, has really helped them. And like I said, it's just the logistics of, you know, Tijuana, if you look at the on a map of Mexico, is so far removed from the, you know, the center of Mexico. It's like, I think it's a 10-hour bus journey for Club Tijuana to the nearest away game in Mexico, in Torreón. So it just gives you a perspective on how much that team has to travel and how used to they are to traveling, and how they go to 2 days before an away game, even in Mexico. So I think that's really helped him in the CONCACAF Champions League, especially with the away games.
I'm sure they'll be really hoping that they can get a US-based side, especially the LA Galaxy, when it comes to the quarterfinals, just to be able to nip over the border quickly and have a game and then be back in time for tea, if you will. With Club America, though, competing on both fronts, very well, of course, in CONCACAF Champions League play, but still in the Apertura season of Liga MX, this is a side that's got two games in hand, 1 point off the top of the league. I know we've only played 8 to 10 games or so, but they're looking like they can compete on both levels at this moment in time.
No, I mean, the amount of money that America has and the quality of the squad that they've got, you know, there's no reason why they can't compete. I'd put America favourites for the CONCACAF Champions League right now. And you have to put them favourites for the Mexican League as well. I mean, it's just a squad that's absolutely full of confidence. The manager, Miguel Herrera, he was, you know, one of the main contenders for the Mexico job when it came up. And I think he will be the Mexico boss in the future, definitely. But, you know, it's a team that, you know, you look at just the strikers and there's 3-4 that are just all on form at the minute. And I mean, they've just got the right squad to mix it in both competitions.
And America as well, you know, a great dominant force. But There can be that time, Tom, when a side maybe gets overconfident with the positive starts and everything. Do you see that maybe creeping into this side at all, or is there enough to maybe keep that level head in this side as they progress?
No, I think they will have a dip, but I mean, I think the way the Mexican league is with the playoffs, I mean, they can get away with having a dip. Because as long as they're in the playoffs, then that's fine. As long as they go into the playoffs on form. I think with the CONCACAF Champions League, I mean, really, the business end is in almost 6 months, isn't it? In, I think, March, when it gets back together. So, you know, there's a long time to go until the knockout round starts. So, you know, the form could be different by then. I mean, it's one of the things about Mexican side, sometimes one of the big problems is consistency. You know, with teams and you know, a team can be challenged for the title 1 year and down at the bottom next year. I mean, I don't think America is going to be that, but I mean, there's always that possibility.
It's always peculiar to me to think about the Apertura and the Clausura seasons in Liga MX and in a number of the South American leagues, Tom. But do you think there's a positive that can be taken from the South American setup having it like that? Do you think it's something that not only works in South America but could work elsewhere in the world and in Europe at all? Or do you think it's just never going to happen? Obviously, it's very unlikely to be changed, but do you think anything would change should that happen?
I mean, I don't like it.
Why not? Why don't you like the two season kind of setup?
Well, I think that it leads to a real short termism in terms of building teams and giving players enough chance and giving managers enough chance and getting the whole like structure throughout a club. I think it's very like, all right, plan for these 6 months instead of like, how are we going to win the league in 4 years? Because at the end of the day, you go and there's only 18 teams in the league, 17 games a season. And, you know, all you need is like, you know, 7-8 wins, a few draws, and you're in the playoffs, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you've got as good a chance as anybody's winning. So, yeah, I mean, there's two things. There's the playoffs as well, which I don't like either. More of a traditionalist, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think it breeds short-termism. And I think it's all done for TV. I mean, it's just... There's a lot of money in Mexican TV, the two big stations. So they have it that way so that there's more big games per year, if you know what I mean. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't. I just think it's. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting when you talk about the national team and you can kind of relate whether the league system needs to be changed so that the Mexican national team can also improve. And you know, I think there's some good arguments that it should be. I mean, at least to make it like Argentina, where they have two leagues a year, but at least the straight leagues without playoffs. So, you know, you have to be very consistent, you know?
Mm. I was going to say that was going to be the next point. Do you think it does have this negative impact on the national team to an extent? But you've kind of already taken the words out of my mouth there, Tom. Just finally then, let's leave it on a national team note. Can you give us a little brief prediction of how Mexico are going to do in these final couple of games? Is it going to be an automatic playoff spot or a qualification spot, or are they going to have to go through the playoffs for this, Tom?
Yeah, I think they'll be playing New Zealand. I think they'll be getting the videos out of New Zealand. Ordering the videos of New Zealand. I think they're going to do it. I mean, it's almost like, I don't know, there's absolutely no option now. But at the same time, you know, they've not won yet at the Estadio Azteca this year. And Panama, you know, they could produce absolute massive shock in the World Game. Next month, and then away at Costa Rica won't be doing Mexico any favours, even though they're already in the World Cup. So more than anything, it's going to be absolute nerve-wracking for anybody who follows or is a Mexico fan.
Well, I hope for your sake, Tom, that you that Mexico do get there, because otherwise it could be a pretty barren summer for you in terms of writing on Mexico national team football next summer, should it not take place. So let's hope that Mexico get in and Tom is able to stay in Mexico and get down to Brazil and cover the World Cup as well, mate. For now, though, we really appreciate you taking the time out to join us, man. Always a pleasure to have a chat with you. It's always so baffling as well to have a Lancashire lad in the heart of Central American football, man, but we always enjoy it.
Yes, well, man, thanks for having us on.
No worries, not a problem. Cheers, mate. Take care and have a good afternoon.
You too, man. Bye bye.
Mr. Tom Marshall there, joining us here on World Football Daily to talk all things Mexican football, talking a little bit about the CONCACAF Champions League, just getting a feel of the setup. We're obviously not in the business end yet of the CONCACAF Champions League. It's around about the quarterfinals when, I think on a personal note, I start to really get kind of drawn into it, because that's when we get a lot of these, I don't want to say minnow sides, obviously, you know, sides like Heredia did reasonably well last year, but you get like Caledonia from Trinidad and Tobago that, you never really stand a chance. Same with, arguably, with Victoria of Honduras. And, you know, you don't get the feeling that they're going to be making any waves in the competition. It really, all you do, did you find that you wait for CONCACAF Champions League just to get down to the kind of the knockout stages with Mexico and the USA? That's what excites me in this tournament. It's not, I don't mind if the US if the US sides go down to maybe like Honduras or somewhere like that, and then you kind of think, oh well, it could be tough, but you'd expect them to do it. It's when they step onto Mexican soil and when the Mexicans head up north of the border that I really get into and get sucked into CONCACAF Champions League and get following it. But a big thanks to Tom Marshall for joining us here on World Football Daily, talking about a little bit of Mexican football, getting his thoughts as well on the Mexican national team. We've heard a lot from Eric Gomez. Nice to see Tom Marshall as well. Eric very much kind of a little more pessimistic last time we spoke to him, but Tom, firm believer, but it's going to be nervy, that's for sure, if you're a fan of Mexican football. If you're a fan of football in general, stick around. There's plenty more to talk about here on World Football Daily, and I'm delighted to say our second guest for the day is ready and waiting to be plugged into our airwaves. And boy, it's been a while since we had this guy on the airwaves as well. Not as long as Tom, but still too long indeed for a very good friend of the show, a man who entertains us with all of his Bundesliga ramblings, both on the web, in our papers, and of course here on World Football Daily as well. He's an absolute legend here of the show. Always a pleasure to stop in with him and talking all things Bundesliga and a little bit of Champions League German football today, I think we'll be specifying on. Mr. Christian Nyari joining us here on the show today. Christian, how are you, mate? It's a pleasure to have you on. It's been too long, as I say. Hope you've been keeping very well, my good man. How are you?
Very, very well, man. And thanks for having me on. It's good to be back, just in time for the Champions League, and I'm here to laugh and cry on behalf of some of the fans there, because it's been a rough week.
As long as you don't go Klopp on us and get into a kind of a vile rage, or we will have to send you down the WFD tunnel and away to the stands.
I apologize for what it's worth.
But it's very surprising, though, isn't it? So kind of uncharacteristic of a guy that we generally see on the sidelines. Obviously, things have generally gone pretty well over the last few years for Klopp, but it generally seems such a happy, kind of friendly, smiling, outgoing character. Surprising to see him like this. What do you think triggered it? What do you think just made him flip like that, Christian?
Well, he's a friendly, outgoing kind of guy, very extroverted, always smiling and happy, but he has a streak of doing things like this. I mean, he was reprimanded in the Bundesliga. I think it was, I don't remember the figure exactly, fined something like 50,000 euros for getting into the face of an official a couple of years back. And then it's happened a couple of times in Germany. Those who don't really watch him in Germany every week, you know, don't really see that. But he has that side to him a little bit. He's just a very, very emotional guy. He wears his emotions on, you know, his heart on his sleeve. As you can see, you know, he lives and experiences the game with his players during a game. You know, he's always jumping, he's running down the touchline, he's celebrating every goal. He once practically almost ate his own cap during a game. he's just that kind of guy. But I mean, he's conscious of it. You know, he said yesterday after the game that, you know, my emotional side is positives and negatives. I'm aware of it. You know, I apologize to the officials personally and my own team, and I'll learn from it. And, you know, I think that's all you can ask of a guy after things like this.
It's obviously a very intense night for the Dortmund manager against Napoli yesterday evening, losing in Naples 2-1. Before we get into the game itself, Dortmund being involved in the group of death again. We've spoken about City's reaction to not being in it. We've spoken about Arsenal's reaction to it on this show. What about in Germany? What's Dortmund's reaction to being in this group of death and their likelihood of getting out of it?
Well, after last year, at the beginning of the season, the campaign last year, there were a lot of worries and people expecting that They weren't expecting Drummond to get out, to be honest with you, just because if you remember the year before last, they were also in a group with Arsenal and Marseille, and they finished last. And it was a pretty disastrous campaign. So people had similar expectations going into last year, and, you know, they exceeded all expectations. And, you know, there's no reason why they can't repeat that. And the sentiment is still that way even after yesterday, which is a little bit surprising. Usually, you know, people are quick to judge and get critical and cynical, but the feeling overall is still very optimistic. You know, it's five games to go, so, you know, still everything to play for.
Plenty of time to change it round, especially against one of these, arguably the strongest side, apart from Dortmund in the group, Napoli, and losing away. Before we get into their possibilities of being able to turn this around, obviously it's early days yet, the game itself, where did Dortmund, do you think, go wrong in this one? Why weren't they able to get a grip on this tie?
I think it's a mix. It's a combination of just bad circumstances with maybe being a little bit too aggressive going forward. I mean, this is the thing about Dortmund. They don't compromise tactically. Regardless of who they're playing, what the other team is doing, or what the situation is in the game, they just play the same way. They just attack. And, you know, I think in Napoli, they came up against a team that defended really well. They kept their shape. They kept Reus and Lewandowski out of the game, and then they just exploited the space behind them. And very few teams have the capability of both defending Dortmund and taking advantage offensively. And Napoli was one of the sides, and, you know, credit to them. I thought they did really well. And I think Benitez is the exact kind of manager they need to do well in Europe. And then it's also circumstances like, you know, Hummels being injured. He's so important for them. And Weidenfeller being sent off. And they were also missing Gündoğan, obviously, and the captain, Sebastian Kehl. So it's a mixture, really. You can't really say that Dortmund were terrible. They maybe could have done better, but I think it's a combination of a few unfortunate circumstances for them that just made it really difficult. I think they did a little bit better in the second half, all things considered, but, you know, by then it was too late. They were already two goals down, and it's difficult for any team in Europe to make that up.
No Aubameyang at the start of this game as well, although Mkhitaryan did start. What was the reason for Aubameyang not playing or not starting the game last night? Made a reasonably early appearance, of course, after the Weidenfeller sending off.
I don't think it was anything too conscious. I think so far this season it's basically been a rotation between Błażejkowski and Aubameyang. I mean, Mkhitaryan and Reus are the set starters, and then it's just a matter of who will play between those two guys. And, you know, it's been back and forth. So, I mean, I think it's going to be like that for the rest of the season in Europe as well, where one of the two will start in the league and the other in Europe. And it's just allowed for a little bit of variation, a little bit of, rotation, keeping the players fit. So I don't think it's anything to read too much into, really.
Do you like that? Do you think it is good to have a rotation? Or do you think maybe picking one or the other as your starter and generating a real chemistry across that front three behind Lewandowski might be important for the future, especially if they're going to compete on both fronts?
Yeah, you can make that argument. I thought actually Aubameyang was probably the best player after he came on yesterday. And he's had, obviously, a really, really good season. But, you know, you still have a player like Błażejkowski who's been doing so well for them for so many years, you know, and Klopp is a very loyal guy. He's not going to free someone out just because he has this new guy in who's, you know, admittedly playing really well. But, you know, Błażejkowski still has a lot to offer as well. And that's really Klopp's charm as well as a manager. He balances the need for rotation and the need for minutes very well across all players. And so far, it hasn't hurt them. I mean, they've done really, really well in the league rotating like that. So, you know, who's to say it can't work in Europe as well?
And rightly so, it has been paying off for Dortmund. Bayern Munich have had a bit of pressure on them in their league season. The discussion, obviously, with Schweinsteiger out, who was going to fill in that defensive midfield role. We saw Lahm on the weekend to kind of take that on for Pep Guardiola's side. And same thing against CSKA Moscow this week in the Champions League. Munich, though, steady as you like against Moscow. How important was this for off-the-pitch matters with the talk around Pep? And there has been so much talk, surprisingly, of kind of discomfort and displeasure with this Bayern Munich side, despite still a very good start to the season.
Yeah, and I find it extremely, well, I'll say it, I find it ridiculous, actually. I just don't think there's much to criticize, you know, all things considered. You know, you take into account it's a new manager who's adjusting to a new culture. I mean, right, he's learned the language really well, and he's speaking it well, he's using it in training, and he's adjusted as quickly as anyone from out coming in from, you know, Spain would in Germany. And, you know, on top of that, he's coming into a team who's won just about everything there was to win. He's trying to manage incredibly high circumstances. Then you have several players injured at the start of the season. I mean, you have Javi Martinez, who's still not match fit. You know, we're approaching the second month into the season. He's still not 100% match fit. Bastian Schweinsteiger has been in and out of the squad. Thiago's out for 2 months. So, you know, you're trying to balance a slew of issues, really. At the same time, you're still winning games. I mean, Bayern are still undefeated in the season. Sure, they have one draw. But, you know, that's the degree of scrutiny on this team now, that a draw is enough for, you know, is enough to throw people off. And I think that's a shame, but, you know, it's, I guess it's the nature of the beast. But, yeah, I think any win now, especially in Europe, is going to go a long way in just easing that pressure.
Are there any other options for Bayern in this defensive midfielder role with Martinez still not match fit and Schweinsteiger out injured, as you say, Christian? Other than Lahm, is there anybody else that you would like to see thrown in there? Because we've seen Lahm be so good out on the flanks over the, you know, last kind of 7 years or so now. It seems peculiar to kind of shift him inside and have him as a kind of holding midfielder.
Yeah, it seems that way. You know, he's just been the one constant in German football for a decade now. Lahm at left back, Lahm at right back, and always doing well. But you know what? He's been excellent in the middle as well, and I think he's one of the few players that can make that transition seamlessly. The issue, of course, is you take him away from the fullback spot, and whoever you put out there will just not, you know, be able to replicate his performances. That's how good he is. But, you know, I think Toni Kroos has been doing well there as well. With Lahm in the middle, he's the deepest guy, but I think Kroos is capable of doing that as well. And, I mean, they still have this guy, Jan Kierhoff, who they signed from Mainz last year. He was, he's faced a couple of injury worries as well so far, but he's coming back to full fitness now, and he has played as a defensive midfielder. So I think if absolutely necessary, we might see him there in the coming weeks, but I think it's only a matter of time before Martinez is back 100% and Schweinsteiger. So I think, if anything, Bayern have weathered the storm. They're past the worst stages, if you can even call it worse. I don't. But, yeah, I don't think there'll be much of an issue anymore.
Yeah, rather than being one of the worst stages, it's more just they're past a stage, isn't it? They're
right,
past
exactly.
A section, and they've dropped 2 points. So it's baffling to think that that's a tragedy in Bayern Munich football. It just shows how far they've come. Bayern Leverkusen, on the other hand, yeah. A very difficult night at Old Trafford on Tuesday. We spoke about it from a Manchester United perspective, but how gutted will Leverkusen be to have not got something at Old Trafford, which has been a stumbling ground for United in the past on Champions League nights?
Right, and, you know, to be fair, I think that this was their most difficult fixture in this group. So I think expectations have to be a little bit geared to that. I know United are not at their best, and, you know, they're still adjusting with a new manager, but I don't think many people were realistically expecting Leverkusen to win this game or maybe get a point at most, but you know, at the end of the day, there's still 5 games left for them. I thought they had spells in the game where they did okay. It definitely, Sami Hyypiä said it wasn't their best game, of course, and he was right. There's things they could have done better. I think they were also, you know, unfortunate not to have their best player start. Lars Bender was, you know, he wasn't fit to start the game, and he's such an important player for them. He might have made a difference. But I think Leverkusen have enough in them to take something from Sociedad. You know, Sociedad wasn't that good in the first game. Shakhtar is going to be a little bit difficult. But this group overall, I think, is very difficult. I think they have the most difficult task of any German club. And, you know, if anyone goes out, it's them. And I don't think it's because they're a bad team. They're just in a tough group.
With that said, then, what's the expectation on from Leverkusen fans? Are you getting from Germany, Christian? I mean, is there a kind of there must be a belief that they can get out of this group, but failure, they're not so bad.
There's cautious optimism. I would say, they're very very well. They're a much improved side, but if you compare them to to teams like Shakhtar, United. Or even their German counterparts in the other groups, they have the least experience of any of them. And, I think experience goes such a long way in this competition, especially if you're in a difficult group like this. So I think if they finish third, it's something that would be acceptable. Obviously not preferred, but, I think Leverkusen are still not at the point where you can expect them consistently to get out of the group stage. And I think that will come with the years. I'm pretty sure they're going to qualify for the Champions League again. In the league, they're doing really, they've had a phenomenal start to the season. And they'll be there again next year. But for now, I think it's important to gear expectations realistically.
I suppose you talk about experience in the Champions League, and there's no better side to learn from than Borussia Dortmund after 2 years ago bowing out, as you said, and then going on to get to the final last year. The final German side in the Champions League, Christian, and we have to remember, A, that there's four, and B, that Schalke did make it, because there was a point where we didn't think they were going to against PAOK Thessaloniki in the qualifying games. Much smoother transition into the group stages with the 3-0 win over Steaua Bucuresti. That's got to be reassuring to Schalke fans that are always, it seems at the moment, on an up and down roller coaster with this side.
I can't even keep track of Schalke anymore. They started so poorly, they barely made it to Champions League, and now they have, three wins in a row, three consecutive clean sheets. They conceded, I think it was eight or nine goals in their first two games in the league, and now they're one of the best defenses around, and it's all happened, since Kevin Prince Boateng came in. Obviously, it's not just him, but I think he gave him a little bit of a kick. Him and Draxler are developing a really, really good chemistry together, and yeah, they were excellent yesterday. And I think what also is a part of it is the signing of Dennis Aogo at left back. He has so much energy in the game. He just single-handedly plays down the left-hand side. He allows Draxler to just come in into the middle and combine with a Farfan, a Boateng, a Salah. And yeah, it's working well for them so far. And with this team, I said this before, I think the squad has always been very, very talented and very capable of performing like this. It was just a matter of just psychologically picking up and getting that first win 2 weeks ago in Germany. Gave them a boost. Winning again this last week gave them another boost. So it's just perpetually building on the confidence they have the previous week, and it's showing. I think they're the front runners now, and I think they could even win the group.
And of course, the snowball effect of confidence, ever important in football, Christian. Just finally then, on Schalke, this will be the last one for us because we're taking up far too much of your time today, Christian, mate. But in terms of this transfer of Boateng, we spoke about how good he is for Schalke. How good is he? You touched on the relationship between him and Draxler, the chemistry coming. How important is he for the development of Julian Draxler?
I think it's very important just because one of the biggest reasons Draxler came along so quickly and so well was because he had a player like Lewis Hope there last year and the year before that. And obviously, Lewis Hope left. He went to England. So for a while there was a gap, just a vacuum, a creative vacuum in the center, someone for a younger player to play off. I think it's so important for young players coming through to have, a role model is kind of a relative term, but just a player to reference off in a game.
Like a safety net, if you will.
Right, exactly. And I think Boateng is that guy. And Boateng was, had that bad boy attitude for so many years. But I really think he's matured as a person and a player. And he wants the responsibility. He wants to be one of the leaders at the team. And this is what he said when he came to Germany. And it's showing. And this is great for a player like Draxler.
And it's great for a team like Schalke as well, who have been so up and down and mixed, such a mixed bag. Hopefully Boateng can come in and steady that ship for them as they progress through the Champions League, along with the remaining German sides. But Christian, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on today to talk about the Champions League and the German side's fortunes in the competition. We'll obviously have you back as soon as we can to talk about Bundesliga football next time on the show. But for now, mate, thank you so much for your time. Take care. And we look forward to catching up with you very soon indeed, mate.
My pleasure.
It's our pleasure to have you on the airwaves. Christian Nyari joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things Bundesliga and their sides' nights in the Champions League over the last 2 days. Of course, Leverkusen starting with that difficult draw away at Manchester United, losing 4-2. It continued, though, positivity for Bayern Munich, a 3-0 win. Schalke replicated Munich's win with a 3-0 win of their own over Steaua Bucharest last night.